The Capital Connection is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals standing with more than 600,000 workers in education, human services, and healthcare with the Our Voice, Our Values, Our Union campaign. And United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Joining this week is Jesse McKinley, the Albany Bureau Chief for the New York Times. We're very proud to have you here, Jesse. Welcome back.
Thanks, Alan.
Let's start at the beginning. The big news, of course, is the impeachment. What do you make of the New York delegation and whether or not, you know, they're in a better spot or a worse spot as a result of the speaker's declaration?
Well, I think it depends on where you live, as a lot of New York politics tends to break. I think for members of the delegation that live in New York City and heavily liberal areas where this is an extremely popular idea, where it's an idea that's been kicked around for months, if not years, I think there's going to be widespread support for the inquiry. And in terms of the politics of it, it's pretty simple. The voters in those heavily Democratic areas want the president impeached. They want him investigated. And they obviously want a Democrat to win in 2020. Now, if you're living upstate where you have more conservative pockets in districts like Anthony Brindisi's in the Utica area, you know, that's a seat that he only just won in 2018. It's a seat that it was a tight race. A lot of money went into that race and a lot of interest from interests outside of New York. And I believe that Brindisi has not said that he does support impeachment yet. Now,
right.
We're at the beginning of this process, so you know, as evidence is gathered, as other bombshells blow up, as tends to happen on a regular basis with this administration, those opinions might change. But I think you're going to see some very careful polling from people like Anthony Brindisi to see you know which way the wind's blowing on this and see if voters support this, if support is gaining or diminishing. And that may well, you know, influence his decision as to whether or not to support it long term. But once again, we're right at the beginning of this process. So,
and of course, the district did go for Trump, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. I think the district as a whole. Of course, those more rural regions, particularly in western central New York, are very strong Trump territory, places where he has actually gone to visit, places where, you know, when you're driving through those areas, you see a lot of Trump 2020 signs. So,
yeah, in the end, it was sort of inevitable. Do you think, I mean, you're the New York State chief here on the New York Times, but do you think that this was pretty well established by the speaker that she was going to, in the end, be for impeachment?
I don't know about that. I mean, I used to be the San Francisco bureau chief, and so I did cover Pelosi a little bit. I think that she is a very savvy and very careful political strategist. And I think that from the beginning, her play on this was actually to kind of tamp down the talk of impeachment. I think there's a fear, not completely unjustified on the left in terms of Democratic political strategists, that this would fire up the Republican base, that it would allow Trump to kind of sit in a position of victimhood, which is a place that he seems completely content to occupy, and would allow him talking points going forward. I don't think that those are invalid concerns if you're a Democratic political strategist. Now, that being said, I think the revelations about the Ukraine conversations may have been, I mean, they were certainly the tipping point in terms of Pelosi's thinking on this. I think that it raised the stakes from, you know, some chatter about collusion, which Mueller obviously uncovered some evidence of, but not enough to you know, or at least in terms of obstruction of justice. There may have been crimes committed by the president, but it wasn't enough to actually get charges brought. This seems, at least from the reporting that's been done by the Washington Post and by the New York Times, the Ukraine stuff seems to be pretty much squarely in the impeachable realm. So I think that it's been these revelations that have pushed Pelosi past the kind of point of caution And I think as more and more information comes out about this, once the transcript is released, once the complaint itself is released, we'll see how much merit that case actually holds.
Now, Jesse McKinley, obviously, we're in the middle of a huge fight for the Democratic nomination. Since you have had such wide exposure as a journalist, does this help or hurt the Biden campaign?
I think at least initially it seems to be helping the Biden campaign. I think it puts the vice president in a position of himself, you know, showing A, that he is feared enough by Trump campaign that he was the source of this call, the source of this seeming, you know, action by the president to try to get some dirt on him and his son, which kind of cements the idea that he is really the one to beat amongst Republicans. So I think that conception probably helps Biden. I think that they've handled it relatively well by saying, if these allegations are true, that it is impeachable, it's allowed Biden to use the impeachment word without completely embracing it, right? So that does two things. One is it appeases the people on the left who have always been a little bit suspicious of Biden because he's too much of a centrist. But it also allows him to still strike a note of caution amongst kind of more central Democrats who are his bread and butter. So I think so far Biden's campaign has handled it pretty well. Now, that being said, the second thought here is that it has given, you know, new flame to these completely unfounded allegations about Hunter Biden, his son, as well as the vice president himself. So it's as though it's given some oxygen to a really nasty, unfounded rumor that most people hadn't heard about otherwise, and now everyone's talking about. So in that regard, it may not be exactly what they wanted.
Yeah, I agree with that. Let me talk to you about the so-called commission. There was a commission established on getting more voter participation, and now there is a sense that it has been a loaded commission. There's an article that you wrote, you and Vivian Wang. What's the basis of this whole thing?
Well, I think there has been a theory since the commission was established in March that while it is set up to look at and establish a public financing committee or campaign committee or a system for state campaigns, that another part of its mission was to get rid of fusion voting, which for the listeners who don't understand that, it means basically if you're a candidate for public office, you can run as a Democrat, but you can also run as a member of the Independent Party or of the Working Families Party or any of the number of small third parties that exist in the state. And you can collect votes on all of these different lines, and then they tally them all up, and that becomes your final vote tally. So for small third parties, it's allowed them some a seat at the table, basically, to make their priorities known. And then if the candidate wants their endorsement, then he has to at least pay lip service to some of the ideas that they have. But under the commission, conceivably, that practice could be ended. And it was that sort of thinking that whether it's meritorious or not, that sort of thinking was given oxygen by Governor Cuomo putting Jay Jacobs, who was a vociferous opponent of fusion voting, on the commission itself. And then subsequent to that, at meetings, Jacobs has asked, you know, anti-fusion voting people to come in and speak and kind of make the case. So all of this seems to be evidence for people, particularly the Working Families Party, that they're trying to kill off the fusion voting, and by killing off fusion voting, killing off parties like the Working Families Party itself. So there's a lawsuit that is being kind of waged over this, but the clock is ticking. You know, the commission is supposed to put out its first report by December 1st. And if the legislature, which just happens not to be in session during December, does not come back, break up their holiday plans and change those recommendations, then it just becomes law. So if the commission says, you know what, we're not going to do fusion voting in the state of New York anymore, and the legislature shrugs and doesn't come back and change it, well, there's no more fusion voting. So that's where their source of concern is. And December, as anyone living in the Northeast knows, is going to come all too soon. So
just to put a cap on this, the Working Families Party thinks that Cuomo is trying to kill them because they supported his opponent, Cynthia Nixon, in the primary campaign. I think there may be some substance to that.
I don't think that there's any loss of bad blood between Cuomo and the Working Families Party. I mean, not only was there the endorsement of Cynthia Nixon, also, you know, the statements going back and forth between those two groups have been borderline nasty on occasions, and I don't think there's any love lost there. So whether or not Cuomo cares enough or holds a grudge enough to actually actively try to kill off a political party, I mean, I think that would depend on your estimation of the governor's vindictiveness and or his interest even in kind of killing off the parties. But I'll leave that to bigger brains to decide.
But it is interesting, Jesse, that the other people who might gain or lose from this are all against the idea. In other words, Chuck Schumer, Gillibrand, there's no support of this whole idea of basically killing these third parties, except by Cuomo.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, fortune building has some big, big name, including Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. You mentioned Chuck Schumer. There's a lot of people that think this is a good idea. And just from a non-political viewpoint, their argument is, look, you know, third parties sometimes have interesting, good ideas. And, if you only have a two-party system where Democrats and Republicans come up with the ideas, then some of these smaller, kind of more either progressive or in some cases conservative ways of thinking don't get a seat at the table and they don't get the influence that they might have. And so just from a Democratic, small d Democratic viewpoint, there's something to be said for the idea that, the marketplace of ideas, you know, that we have all these concepts, and that if you eliminate the way in which those parties get some sort of influence, then you're doing the democracy, once again, small d, some damage. And I think that is an interesting and somewhat credible legal and or philosophical idea.
Jesse McKinley, has the New York Times taken a stance on this yet?
I believe we have said that the commission, and this is the other side of the brick wall on the editorial side, they have said that the Public Financing Commission should concentrate on public financing and that fusion voting is a different issue and should not be wrapped up in the same ball of wax.
And while we're on this political question, there is the Working Families Party, which has endorsed Elizabeth Warren, not Bernie Sanders, and Washington Square Park was filled.
Yeah, I mean, and I think the Quinnipiac poll that came out showed that Warren is surging. And I think I think the Washington Square Park rally really may have been a turning point for her campaign, just in terms of the visuals it offered. That was a very powerful image of seeing, 20,000 people kind of bathed in spotlights in front of this iconic arch. You know, it really did, in terms of political optics, it was a doozy. And it has coincided with Warren slowly picking up steam and really becoming this number two candidate in this campaign. I think for Bernie Sanders, it's vexing because they occupy a very similar political lane. You know, they really are the no holds barred left wing candidates in this race, whereas Biden is kind of running in the center. So I think for Bernie Sanders, it's problematic. And I also think that, you know this better than anyone, politics can be a very fickle business and people come in and out of fashion pretty quickly. And in 2016, if you were a very liberal voter who really wanted change and wanted to, make your voice heard, Bernie Sanders was this breath of fresh air that was really kind of speaking your language. And now, 4 years later, he's people have heard a lot of this before. And Elizabeth Warren, who has come out with these very comprehensive plans on everything from the environment to Indian health care to, climate change, et cetera, she is kind of finding those voters. Those voters are finding her. So I think it's been difficult for Sanders to kind of once again present himself as the kind of new change candidate when Warren's kind of running in that space right now. So we shall see. It's still, we have 14 more months of this, so it's going to be a long campaign.
Yeah, 14 more months of this is right. You know, I went to NYU, I did my doctorate at NYU, and 20,000 people in Washington Square Park, pretty impressive.
Yeah, that's a sunny afternoon in July. I went there. I'm a Violet as well, Alan. We're a fellow alumnus of New York University.
Okay, so let's go to the state side now. And now we have Andrew Cuomo, who spent his life decrying the Republicans like his father did, but using the Republicans in the New York State Senate. Now, all of a sudden, he is saddled with a bunch of Democrats. And there does seem to be some tension between him and the Senate Democrats. And I get the idea sometimes that he's fighting with them as if they were the old Republicans.
You know, I covered the 2019 legislative session, which was the first session in which the Democrats had taken control of the Senate. Yeah. And you are not mistaken. The governor fought with the Democrats, particularly in the Senate, repeatedly. You know, he lobbed a lot of insults at them. He kind of said they were amateurs. They didn't know what they were doing. You know, he got in a squabble with his chief senior advisor and your former student, Rich Azzopardi, got in a very nasty squabble with three young female lawmakers who he used an epithet to refer to them as idiots. And, you know, it was not a kumbaya moment at all for the Democrats and Andrew Cuomo. And I think for his money, he's like, well, you know, I've got to do what's best for the state, and I got to do what's best for me, and I got to do what's best. And, you know, some of these ideas are impractical, or they are going to cost too much, or they're crazy, or they're and the new progressives in that caucus, in the Democratic Senate caucus, really want to make changes, and they really want their ideas heard, and they don't want to be told no, and they want to make their voices heard. And that is going to be a conflict. And it might be a partially kind of almost a generational conflict. You know, Governor Cuomo is from a different political generation. He's from the kind of Clintonian Democratic Party. And the Democratic Party that they represent is not that. You know, it's the progressives who have come of age during Donald Trump's administration. There are people that are fired up by that administration, and there are people that don't want to be told no, and they don't want to be told that their ideas are impractical. They want to be heard. And so I think you see that sort of tension. And certainly, you know, you did a good interview with Cuomo last week where you said, you know, you worked well with the Republicans, and the governor tried to kind of walk away from that. And I think that is a very difficult argument for him to make, that he did not do a lot of work with Republicans. His arguments, again, would be, well, I was just trying to get things done. But I think there was a comfort level for a centrist Democrat who has a lot of years under his belt in terms of, you know, working with Republicans, particularly in places like Long Island. There was a comfort level in, you know, kind of knowing the guys in the room, and they were often guys who he could cut deals with. And now that dynamic has certainly changed, particularly in the Senate. So
does this go to the point of mutual self-destruction?
I don't think so. I mean, the 2020 cycle is shaping up, particularly in a state like New York, to be a pretty good one, I would suspect, for Democrats again. You know, if you talk to Democratic political consultants in the state who watch the Senate, you know, they argue, hey, we might pick up another two or three seats, you know, particularly if Democrats get really fired up by Donald Trump and come out to the polls in the numbers that they did in 2018. So success breeds a lot of friendships. And I think Democrats continue to pick up seats in the Senate, particularly whatever agita and or animus exists between the governor and the Senate may actually diminish, because they might see, okay, well, we're in it for the long haul. Because once the Democrats get 42 or 43 seats in the Senate, that would probably take a long time for the Republicans to chip away at that and once again get power back in that chamber. So they may not, you know, be invited to each other's, you know, children's picnics, but they're going to have to work together because they're going to be together for a while.
Jesse McKinley of The New York Times, talk to us a little bit about the governor's plan to move the primaries around. What's that all about?
Well, I think that there, once again, are two schools of thought on this. I think from the governor's viewpoint, he feels it's silly to have separate dates for federal and state and local primaries because it costs money. You got to get the poll workers out. You got to get the polls open. You got to turn the lights on. You know that it's costing millions of dollars per year to have these primaries on different dates. Now, there was also a school of thought that he was at one point trying to move the New York primary all the way up to kind of give, you know, into like the February range, to give New York kind of a bigger seat at the table, and that this would also have the secondary effect of giving progressive candidates on the left who might be challenging, you know, kind of centrist Democrats in the Assembly and the Senate, it would give those progressive candidates less time to raise money. It would give them less time to get the signatures to get on the ballot. It would give them less time to raise their name recognition. And so that would kind of be a favor to a bunch of kind of older Democrats who might be facing primaries, you know, people like Joe Lentol in Brooklyn and elsewhere, who are all of a sudden, who have been in office for, you know, 20, 30 years, who all of a sudden might be facing kind of a young firebrand on the left. Now, at the end of the day, that didn't happen. The February plan kind of got floated and shot down almost as soon as it did. But I think from their viewpoint, it gave credence to the idea that, once again, to go back to this generational thing, that, you know, mainstream Democrats in New York are worried. You know, they're worried that they're going to get primaried from the left, and their concerns are not completely without merit. You know, I think that there's a lot of primaried from the left, you know, that they'll get young progressive candidates from the left who will try to get them out of office via primary.
And that they will get, in fact, AOC'd, as we say.
Exactly.
Is there a shot that that'll happen? I mean, a guy like Joe Lenthal, he's been around for 1,000 years. I mean, you know, I'm 78. All I got to tell you is he's been around for a good deal of my career.
Yeah, I think it is going to happen. And I think it's going to happen not only in the Senate, but I think it's going to happen even in the Assembly, where, you know, the Democrats have so many seats in the Assembly that it doesn't, you know, if one Democrat switches out for another Democrat, it's not going to make a difference in terms of the balance of power. But there's, you know, Kathy Nolan, who is an esteemed lawmaker in the Assembly, there is chatter that she might get primaried. You know, these are formidable and long established candidates who are on lists of progressive targets going into the election cycle next year. So I absolutely think you're going to see primaries. And I think some of those are going to be hard fought, and they may be closer than the establishment would like.
You've been watching the politics of the church. A lot of trouble. Rochester declaring bankruptcy, the diocese there. What are the implications?
Well, you know, the CVA was passed last year. And I think even as it was passed, one of the most interesting things about it was that it included this one-year look back, which just in layman's terms basically allows cases that may have been unreported on or unaddressed from 20, 30, 40 years. It allowed 1 year of legal kind of open season for these cases to be brought against people that sexually abuse minors, you know, from 20, 30, 40 years ago. And there has been a deluge of these cases, which speaks to a couple of things. One is that if they're all true, it is horrendous and just absolutely repulsive that this sort of behavior was going on. But for the institutions that may have sheltered these people, the pedophiles, you know, in question, that it is potentially financially disastrous for them because these lawsuits will be asking for millions upon millions and millions of dollars worth of, you know, if these allegations are true, well-deserved recompense. So for the Diocese of Rochester, they declared bankruptcy, which was a move that in and of itself really sparked a lot of outrage amongst victims groups because it seemed to them, at least, that they were trying to dodge responsibility before the credibility of the cases had even been established. So I don't think this is going to be the last organization at all to try to seek some sort of financial protection in the federal courts. And I think the cases are going to keep coming. And it will probably be years of litigation before we know the truth behind all of them. But the very fact that there have been so many cases filed and that so many people are alleging this terrible abuse is really frightening. But it's also, I think, for people who supported the Child Victims Act, it shows, you know, that this was a piece of legislation that was long overdue.
Jesse McKinley, you wrote a very interesting article about dangerous animals. What was that about?
Well, I mean, this was big news. This was the
big news.
The funnest thing I got to write last week was, you know, about the various categories of animals that have now been deemed dangerous by the Department of Environmental Conservation, including foxes and bears and lynxes and all these exotic, beautiful animals that people probably should not be keeping as pets. You know,
you shouldn't pet one.
Don't pet one and don't keep one as a pet. But the state has long, you know, had these kind of broad categories of animals that, you know, you don't want, you know, keep tied up in your living room. But this was a regulation where they basically said, they spelled out in very specific terms what sort of animals were considered dangerous, which includes things like pythons and vipers. And, you know, and this came after a series of, you know, incidents where, you know, people were getting bit by black mambas and you know, attacked by chimpanzees and all these things. And it really, for people that are scared of animals or snakes, which I'm certainly scared of, this seemed like a very sensible move. But then on the other hand, there were some animal rights activists who said, look, you know, these sorts of government intrusions into either kind of professional businesses, because there are still, you know, some roadside zoos and places where you can go see these animals up close and personal, that these sorts of restrictions are actually, you know, going to hurt their business. And I think if you're in that camp, there's some credibility to that. Now, that being said, I'm not going to bring a black mamba snake home anytime soon. So
I was going to ask you if you had an alligator in your bathtub.
That's a very personal question. I'm not going to answer that.
Well, you know, you make a very good point. Andrew Cuomo for vice president. Any chance that's going to happen?
You know, I think that hadn't floated for a while. I think that is an unlikelihood. I'll explain for a couple of reasons. One is that, you know, that would presuppose that Biden gets the Democratic nod and he wants kind of a like-minded fellow centrist to kind of run and show that they are, you know, men of action who will take this country back to times of sanity and peace. And, you can almost hear these campaign slogans being drafted. But I think that if Biden does, in fact, become the candidate, it's going to be a hard-fought race. And I think that there will be cries for diversity on that ticket. And, I think people are right to clamor for people of color to be on presidential tickets, for women and other minority groups who have been traditionally overlooked to be represented. And I think that those forces are going to have a very loud voice when it comes to picking a vice presidential candidate. I think a more kind of interesting kind of, and once again, this is highly speculative, but if a Democrat were to win in 2020, particularly someone like Joe Biden, whether or not the governor would be tapped for, a cabinet seat of some sort. And the one that is kind of floated, you know, in cocktail conversation most often is attorney general. You know, he has the governor obviously served as the state's attorney general here in New York. He has legal experience. He can certainly manage a gigantic organization like the Department of Justice. So I think that if a Democrat was elected in 2020, would be a job that conceivably the governor could be qualified and considered for.
Well, we're out of time. It's always too fast. Our guest, Jesse McKinley, the Albany Bureau Chief of the New York Times. Jesse, thank you so much for honoring us with your presence. It really is a great thing for us to have you, and we very much appreciate it.
I appreciate it. Thanks so much.